Welcome to the Seneca Podcast, a weekly discussion of current affairs in China, coming to you from the pop-up Chinese studio here in Beijing. I'm your host, Kaiser Guo. Co-host Jeremy Goldcorn is off this week on baby duty. We are delighted to be joined today by two guests from the Committee of 100, an organization formed over 20 years ago among prominent Chinese Americans to address issues within the Chinese American community, as well as issues in the Sino-American relationship. Angie Tang is the executive director of the Committee of 100. She was appointed regional representative for the U.S. Department of Labor by President George W. Bush in 2001. She previously served as executive director of Mayor Giuliani's Office of Immigrant Affairs and Language Services. She was elected a term member of the Council on Foreign Relations and was a founder of the Pan-Asian American Leadership Caucus. Welcome to Seneca, Angie.
Thank you so much for having us.
We're also delighted to welcome Mercy Guo, no relation that I'm aware of, although she pronounces her surname Ku, the committee's research director and author of Contending with Contradiction, China's Policy Toward Soviet Eastern Europe and the Origins of the Sino-Soviet Split. Mercy, thanks so much for taking the time to join us on Seneca.
Good to be here. Thanks, Kaiser.
So today our focus is on people-to-people relations between Americans and Chinese. I doubt many, and certainly among our listeners, this is even more so, would challenge the assertion that Sino-American relations are the most important relationship for people of both countries, even for the world maybe. The people-to-people aspect of the relationship is of growing importance to presenting a very different set of challenges from state-to-state relations. So, late last month, the Committee of 100 released the U.S.-China Public Perceptions Opinion Survey 2012, an extensive survey of attitudes among ordinary people, business leaders, and opinion leaders in both countries. Policymakers, I think, were included also in the U.S. This was undertaken between mid-December 2011 and the end of January of 2012, is that right?
That's correct.
Okay, so the U.S. survey was undertaken by Harris, no slouches, and it's the fourth such survey that you guys have done, right?
Correct, since 1994.
Okay, so we had a 2001, a 2005, a 2007.
Correct.
Right. Okay, anyway, it's an absolutely fascinating read, and it's got a very impressive level of granularity. It's presented, I have to say, in a very attractive kind of infographic format, so it's fun to look at. Yeah, and I highly encourage listeners to press pause right now and download the thing at survey.committee100.org. That's committee100.org, and look at it as we talk. So we're going to make the 2012 survey and how its findings differ from those of similar recent surveys the centerpiece of our discussion today, but we'll also talk more broadly about the committee's important work and about the general state of people-to-people relations. Angie, for those of our listeners who are not familiar with the Committee of 100, can you give us an introduction to the organization and the work that you guys do?
Absolutely. We were founded in the shadows of a very deciding event in 1989, I think we all know, during which many of the media in the U.S. were inundating Chinese-American elites about the state of U.S.-China relations at a time when our founder, I.M. Pei, the master architect, felt that there should be a platform for voices and that represent a spectrum of different opinions. And he then went on to found a Committee 100 with Yo-Yo Ma and a number of others. The founders of five members and then slowly grew to about 20. And today we enjoy members from every part of the U.S. as well as the Greater China region, and we number 158 as of today.
So you don't actually have to be Chinese American to be...
Members of the Committee 100 are U.S. citizens of Chinese descent, and they do have to pledge their interests and or experience in promoting constructive relations between the U.S. and China.
Okay. And what sorts of projects do you guys get involved in besides sort of being available to talk on the many shows that you guys appear on?
Well,
like this one,
obviously. And Our programming are centered in three areas, with education exchange being a very prominent part of our programming direction that I'm sure we'll chat about. And research definitely is an area that helps set that direction for programming. In addition to education exchange, we also run projects in public diplomacy, which really features these people-to-people exchanges that we are talking about today, as well as leadership development projects, programs that are in the U.S. and here in China.
Great, great, great. So let's move on and talk about the survey itself. Perhaps, maybe Mercy, you could start by sharing with us the top-level findings of the survey and the trends that maybe jump out at you as most significant.
Well, I would, for those of those listeners who have been able to download the book, I would say I would just point them to the executive summary findings, because these are really the salient themes that come out.
Mm-hmm.
First is the sense of shared global leadership that both China and the U.S. bear going forward, the importance of the need to understand both countries' strategic interests and the importance of constructive leadership from both countries.
That's something that everyone on both sides
they recognize.
Right.
Yes. The second is, while there are favorable views among both countries' publics, the American and the Chinese public, there's also a reserved sense of trust, or in other words, there's a favorability viewing in terms of how they view each other on a general level, but
55%
both, right. Yeah, majorities on both sides. However, there's some reservations about where trust can be built, that'll be on specific issues that we can talk about later. Another theme is how domestic concerns and divided views also come to the surface, and what the survey talks about here is many American. The public and the elite, as well as the Chinese, they have also they're concerned about domestic issues. So that affects their perceptions. For example, whether it's job losses in the U.S.
Mm-hmm.
or social unrest as we're seeing played out in China, that affects how they are divided on their views toward both their governments, how they think about
their own governments,
and then their other countries' governments.
I see.
And then finally, the sense of hope and fear about military and economic issues. There is a clear recognition on both sides, both respondents, American and Chinese, that China is rising as an economic power. However, there's also a sense of, if it rises militarily, what are the implications for geostrategic relations?
Right. Was any of that surprising to you, though?
Well, if you're a China watcher, probably not. But for, I think, just the general public, if we're watching current trends, maybe not so surprising, but it's just becoming more pronounced with each event, you know.
Right.
I think among a lot of China watchers, just the very top level numbers were somewhat surprising.
Yeah,
they looked at a 55% favorability rating of Americans, of the general American public, toward China.
Yeah.
And I think that probably surprised a lot of people, because especially in light of the fact that that's actually up from the 2007 survey. I think if you were to have polled a lot of casual or even very serious China watchers and asked them what they thought, if they looked at the barometric pressure, or they took the temperature of public opinion in America toward China, I think most of us, myself included, would have said, you know, precipitous decline.
Well, in fact, Kaiser, we did ask the question of American elites, of a guessing question, whether what they thought the American public favorability rating would be. And that was very low.
Very overestimated.
That was very low.
Oh, right, that's
very
right.
Low.
Underestimated,
right. Right, it's very underestimated at 20%. And the Chinese respondents, however, exactly the opposite.
Yeah, that was an interesting thing. They tended to totally overestimate the Chinese public's favorability ratings of the United States. So what do you suppose accounts for this disconnect?
In fact, Kaiser, there is a disconnect. It's a trend in disconnect that we have observed in over the years with the several surveys that we have studied. And it bears out the trend that there is that divergence between the general public and the elites on both sides. And through we can take you through a number of those questions, and there are a number of very interesting findings where both Chinese and American publics differ very differently than their elites counterparts.
That's very interesting. Let's talk specifically about what other polls we're referring to here. One of them is a China Daily Gallup and China Daily poll.
Correct.
The numbers that came out of that, let me see if I have them here. So the Gallup China Daily poll found that about 42% of Americans have a favorable view of China, while 44% have an unfavorable view. Pew also had a poll which was on sort of attitudes towards China's rise, and that was also quite recent. It comes closer to your results with favorability ratings, to call them.
It's still 40%.
I thought it was 51%. Is that the Pew one?
The Pew one, 40% favorable, 40% unfavorable, with 20% unexplained.
Okay. I may have typoed here on my notes. What I thought was one possibility was when you took the poll.
Correct.
I actually went online. I did a Google News search for China for the period between December 14th and January 31st, and it was a remarkably quiet period. There were no...
Right, and it's the holiday.
Right, it was an early Chinese New Year.
Right, and it's also in anticipation of Vice President Xi Jinping's visit.
There was
a euphoric exchange in many of the media reports about these good, feel-good feelings.
That's right. People were talking about the farmer in Iowa that he was going to go visit.
A lot of biographical sketches of both countries and landmark exchanges.
I looked at the Chinese media, too. During that time, I did a Baidu News search for that period and found that also, there were no screeds published in People's Daily, no anti-American rants. I thought that might have had something to do with it. It's interesting to see that you seem to agree.
Well, timing is always a factor. When in fact you can look at some of the other, for example, in Pew, which was published recently in July. We don't know the exact timing of the fieldwork, but if one has to guess, it's sometime over spring, April, May.
Uh-huh.
Then that makes a period when there's quite a bit of turbulence over the Diaoyu-Tai conflict, where there was maybe the Chengguocheng issue may have been serviced already.
Sure.
And South China Sea, all of that plays into the national mood.
Right. None of this. I mean, this was all your poll was taken before the Bo-Xi-Lai scandal broke.
Right, and during the holiday.
All that stuff, right?
Right.
Which is interesting. I thought that really made a lot of sense to me.
Right, and the Gallup poll, though, the period of November to December, that actually was taken a bit before the holiday, when people are getting ready to get ready. And so there is this very hurry rush, not quite ready to respond to do survey, period. And whereas ABC Washington Post poll was done in February. In fact, that was a period, if you noticed, that where unemployment rate was quite high, that was actually spiked to 9.7%. So seasonal reports from the Bureau of State Labor Statistics with job reports really does have a play on the stock market and people's mood.
Yeah, absolutely. One thing that I thought was interesting in the Gallup China Daily poll was the much higher favorability toward the Chinese or toward China among the 18 to 34 set. Did you look at demographics as at age as a factor in response, Mercy?
Yes, in the C100 survey we had a breakdown in that same cohort. And
did you also find similarities?
Yes,
that's encouraging.
It is.
Yeah, that is very encouraging from where I sit. Anyway, you had a couple of very interesting questions that I thought were amusing. One of them was the first thing to come to mind that comes to mind when the answers and how they've changed over the years. What can we conclude from that? I mean, I noticed a sizable uptick from like 5% from 18 to 23%, so uptick of 5%, and answering largely positive. You know, culture, history, food, Great Wall as the answer that Americans gave. Is that because we're including Great Firewall in Great Wall?
but Kaiser, I mean, there's a drop-down menu of about 20 topics that were read to the respondents, and only the ones that register above 5% were listed.
We're included.
But others that did not make it, you would be astounded.
Outsourcing.
Food safety. Human rights, intellectual property rights, none of them made over 5%.
Wow, that's
and you would think that with the amount of media reports every day we read about IPR with job loss.
This is general public reports.
That is general public.
It must have looked very different
that
among elite.
Correct.
Right.
I mean, another thing that totally
it bears it out too in elite.
Oh,
actually.
Really? Mm-hmm. So it's still more culture, food, Great Wall. Mm-hmm. Than it is
booming economy.
Outsourcing
the economy has quite
sure,
a bit.
Sure, sure.
Economic growth has quite a bit of impression amongst the business elites, obviously.
Another thing that really, I mean, this was just so glaring to me when you looked at it on the infographic was the sort of the flashpoints one, the potential areas for conflict. Americans tended to emphasize trade, human rights, industrial espionage, and cybersecurity. I mean, this is both general public and elites, whereas for China, as always, it's about regional security, you know, Asia-Pacific, and especially about Taiwan. So what's behind this disconnect? I mean, that one was just – is it just simply a function of what gets reported in the media in the respective countries?
Partly, it is event-driven. And you know, just as a caveat, any survey, you always have to see what is the context at the time when it's taken.
Mm-hmm.
In terms of regional security, of course, everything with the Diaoyutai, mm-hmm. you know, everything going on there, that's been ongoing and it's escalating. So that's very much front and center.
Diaoyutai, for our listeners who aren't familiar, are the disputed islands called Senkaku by the
Senkaku
Japanese.
Senkaku by Japan, right. And then Taiwan is always in the backdrop when you talk about U.S.-China relations. It's very clear from the data that both sides can consider cross-strait relations as a strategic issue. However, the Chinese view the resolution of the cross-strait issues as peacefully evolving, whereas the U.S., 5 years ago, they were asked, or the respondents were asked, should the U.S. take action in the event of a military conflict. There was some reservation about it, but there was support for, you know, active
the intervention.
Right. Whereas now, we asked, if Taiwan were to declare independence, should the U.S. intervene? And there's
We're sick of wars now.
I think there's some war fatigue there,
absolutely.
Expressed in that data. So that also shows some reservations about getting too involved in cross-strait issues. Although the both publics realize that it is still very much an essential part of U.S.-China relations.
What kind of feedback, Angie, are you getting about the survey from Chinese people that you've talked to since?
I think that they bear out what we're seeing in current events right now, what's happening with the protests, for example. A lot of the unrest that are due to environmental issues.
Mm-hmm. Shufang, you're referring
Shufang
to.
Shufang and Wukan and Jiaxing and all of these concerns on environmental issues are reflected in the data when we ask about their top concerns, when we ask the Chinese public and the elites to rate the Chinese government's performance in handling environmental issues. Very negative.
Right.
And from 5 years ago, in fact, significant.
Fallen off a cliff. Yeah.
Yes.
Very interesting. I thought that was fascinating. There is just so much in that we could get into.
Right.
Another thing, Ajay, I wanted to say with you on this that I thought was interesting was a change of position after visitation. Mm-hmm. So we had 41% of Americans in the general public who after visiting China said that their impressions were more favorable. While a comparable percentage of the Chinese general public was also more favorably impressed after visitation, what struck me was the number who were less favorably impressed after visitation. So it's presumably after having gone to the United States, they thought, not as good as I thought. I'm less favorably impressed. That went from only 5% of people saying less favorably in 2007 to a whopping 28% in 2012. I mean, that was What, Angie, Mercy, whoever you want to take this, what accounts for this? That was was it just sort of this kind of schadenfreude that this is like, ha, you guys, your infrastructure sucks, ha, I've suspected all along.
Well, I mean, in 5 years, a lot has happened, kind of, right?
True.
I mean,
this
5 years ago, China wasn't the number two economic power.
Right.
5 years ago, China also did not see the U.S. as a strategic partner, and neither did the U.S.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And 5 years after, there is more of this intertwined destinies.
Right.
At the same time, with more understanding, I think the Chinese public and have been more sophisticated in their travel, and that could be a factor.
Yeah, absolutely. Mercy, did you want to take a stab at that one? Do you think that's it? Basically, the sort of rising economic might of China is
that definitely is a factor, and in a sense, I think it's good because. There's the Hollywood view of, say, whether it's the U.S. or China. But then when people actually go to the country and see, they say, oh, this is the reality of the situation. And they're more realistic, you know, and there's more of an on-the-ground realism about, oh, okay, this is what it's all about. So there are no more illusions. And I
right.
think that is a very good first step toward, okay, having a candid conversation on the people-to-people level.
I'd really love to see a survey that looked at Americans after lengthy visitation. People come here initially and they are disabused of this
right.
idea that people are marching around in uniforms and
mouse
suits.
Exactly.
And
right.
But then after a while, after you know, enduring the traffic in the air here for a while, and then you know, seeing those little things that wear at you day to day.
Yeah,
I mean,
sure.
it can swing right back the other way, as it has many a time in my case.
That would be a very important sample group.
Yeah,
yes.
yet another disconnect. The survey seems to show that Americans believe that they accept China's status as a rising power. The Chinese public, on the other hand, by like I think it was a 2-to-1 margin, a huge margin, think that the U.S. is actively trying to prevent China's rise. Was that's a significant change from 5 years ago as well, where there weren't that many people who were sure that America was out to stymie and contain China. What's happened in the intervening 5 years to change Chinese public opinion so much on that issue? It's a tough one.
Well, I think the Chinese public also has changed. If you looked at the trend line in the personal gold of the public, 5 years ago, the U.S. public, like the Chinese public, number one personal goal was to have a happy family.
Mm-hmm.
5 years now, in 2012, the Chinese public, number one personal goal is to get rich.
Right.
And that's, I was talking about the Beijing Jingshen with a public official here. And he very, very quickly corrected me. It's not the stated four things that have been that you've
patriotism,
seen around
innovation,
patriotism,
yeah, inclusiveness,
embracing inclusiveness, and innovation, and but it's to get rich.
Yeah, stacking. Yeah, that's so utterly depressing. I don't even know where to begin, but.
And I also wanted, there's another theme, there's a leitmotif here of the disconnect between the public response and the elites. For example, when polled about as a superpower what China should do, everyone agree that the number one priority should be to stabilize the economy and to improve the quality of life. That,
sure.
that was the number one priority. But number two is very different amongst the public and the elites. Number two amongst the Chinese public was to militarize, to protect national interests.
Wow.
But amongst the elites, however, social issue.
Right.
About the rule of law and controlling communicable diseases.
Mm-hmm. It was funny because I was sort of answering these questions myself, you know, being a kind of functionally bicultural person as an American, as a Chinese person. And I found that I lined up very much with the sort of both the Chinese and the American sort of elite,
mm-hmm.
and was painfully aware of my disconnect with
right.
with the general public opinion. And I've always fancied myself to be somebody who, you know, for whom the general public's opinion matters very much.
Right.
I mean, we're living in a time mm-hmm. where, as I've said many times before, popular attitudes, well, in America, of course, because you have, you know, a functioning democracy, but in China too, where people are constantly taking the temperature now of public opinion, and it shapes policy. It constrains policy. It sometimes very much strains it. And so it matters a lot now. I mean, it's really important.
Even amongst U.S. China watchers, thought leaders, they're always constantly after what the Lao Baixing is thinking.
Right, or they think they know what the Lao Baixing is thinking. I mean, and one measure of it, and one that something that we talk about incessantly on this show, is internet public opinion. Mm-hmm. One thing that didn't really show up in the survey was the impact of the internet on these attitudes. This is something that I've done quite a bit of work on. Mm-hmm. I started a book on this and gave a lot of talks about this particular topic. I mean, and it's the thing that sets me to, you know, deep throes of depression. I mean, because I look at the kind of discourse that you see online between Chinese and Americans. I mean, if you roll the clock back, you know, even just 10, 15 years, most of the interaction between Chinese Americans, virtual or otherwise, it was very stage managed. It was, you know, these sister city relationships. It was delegations of I mean, and everyone was on their best behavior. Mm-hmm. Everyone was out to impress, and you know, we didn't know each other very well, and so we liked each other just fine. Mm-hmm. I feel like the internet, rather than, you know, bringing us all closer together, has brought us closer together, where we can, you know, we know what's wrong with one another.
It goes both ways, yes.
Right. That would be an interesting thing to see in maybe future studies, if you could sort of look at internet users versus a genuinely randomly sampled. I mean, this is something that's constant. It's become now, I mean, as you both are probably fully aware, so de rigueur for a journalist to just go to Weibo for their so-called sampling of
flash.
Exactly. And rather than going out and talking to the real Lao Baixing.
Right.
I wonder if that has had a negative effect, at least on elite perceptions, because, you know, like you said, you know, we underestimate all the elites on both sides, on the Chinese. We very much underestimate favorability. And I hope that they're right. I hope that's correct. I mean, I would like to think that it isn't like that, you know, where there's a story on a Chinese coal mine disaster and everyone lines up so you can say the most egregiously offensive thing about, you know, dead Chinese people. It's pretty horrible. Let me look at one other thing that I think came out of the ABC News Washington Post poll, which was released on the 14th. And again, this was on the eve of Xi Jinping's visit. It noted that partisanship and ideology really colored people's views on China. So the favorable to unfavorable gap is much sharper among self-reporting Republicans. It was, you know, 41 points, 26 to 67. Than among independents or Democrats, which were only, you know, a 13 and 5 point spread respectively. So, and China is likewise seen much more negatively by conservatives, especially strong conservatives, compared with liberals and moderates. So partisanship and ideology, which are roughly equivalent now in American politics anyway. Did you guys look at political partisanship in the study of American political elites?
Our U.S. polling company looked into it. Harris Interactive looked into it. We did not incorporate it explicitly into the findings, but there was that delineation in the data composite of the respondents.
Really interesting, interesting. And then finally, I mean, generational change. You know, in the 1829 set, it was like favorable over unfavorable by like 2-to-1 margin, and it's exactly the reverse among the elderly. What do you think? I mean, is this sort of residual Cold War hostility among older people?
Well, remember the visitation factor too.
Right.
The older generation may not have a chance to visit, may not have a chance to go to the internet.
That's right. So you guys have recommendations too. I mean, that's what I think is really interesting. What it is that you think we ought to do, you know, to make, you know, drawing on the results of the survey, to make positive change in people-to-people relations. And I think you outlined three things: educational exchange, public diplomacy, leadership development. Can you go into each of these a little bit more and tell us what we as concerned bicultural people, as people who are interested in China and believe in the importance of bridge building. Right. What can we do along these things?
Well, take education exchange, for example. We have, the Committee of 100 has been taking delegations, more than this is a sister city kind of delegation photo op visits. We bring thought leaders from America, journalists, civic leaders, and teachers, individuals that have a platform of influence that can have that transformative impact while with their change by their visitation broaden perspective that they could actually extend to a sphere of reach. And we also take a special caution to select individuals who have not visited China before, who are not China experts, who can then share what they've seen in China with others. We've taken journalists for the last 4 years. We've taken teachers, American high school teachers, for 6 years. We've taken civic leaders, whether they're Latinos, African Americans, or lately we've had a diversified civic leaders group from all over the country. In fact, currently we're taking a group of high school teachers who have spent 3 weeks here in China, first week on a study tour, and 2 weeks in Hangzhou studying about sustainability developments in China. And it's a feature program of the 100,000 Strong initiative that President Obama announced in 2009 when he first visited China.
Which is, I mean, I think the greatest thing that came out of the 2009 trip. I mean, it basically went unnoticed by the press, but I latched onto that. I thought that was a terrific thing. I mean, in my experience, it's really only prolonged exposure that can build that kind of empathy. I assume, though, that in your work, just hearing you talk, that you're not the sort of person who would only give them the sort of happy China tour, that you're not going to be sweeping things under the rug.
At all, Kaiser. We show them the good, the bad, and the ugly.
That's good. That's good. I mean, because it's an article of faith for me that you should be grabbing those third rails in these discussions and not shy away from the very difficult discussions.
And these are Pulitzer Prize winners. They have a way of probing, finding their way.
They
are not going to be spun.
Good. I'm really glad to hear it. I really hope that I wish you the best of luck in that endeavor, because I really think that there's nothing that builds these sorts of relationships better than exposure. And they really do need to see China in warts and all. I mean,
yes,
they need to see it all.
Correct.
What about the other direction? What about is the committee involved in bringing Chinese people to the United States and building relations in that direction as well?
Right. For journalists, for example, there are other groups that have done it, and we find that it may be less of a reach for them to change their views for Chinese journalists, who many of whom are self-censored and may not have the chance to really express what they see or their change horizons, or have a really aha moment and have a chance to extend to their reach to a larger audience. But we do have dialogues, and we host meetings with thought leaders from China on a very regular basis.
Mm-hmm. History teachers. Mm-hmm. I would love to bring a delegation of high school history teachers from China to the U.S. And
in fact, in Hangzhou, this group of teachers we brought from San Francisco, they are having dialogues with local teachers in Hangzhou.
Can you share anything from those dialogues? What sorts of encounters are happening? What kinds of?
Well, Angie and I have both been in Hangzhou this past week, and there are 18 of these American high school teachers, and we've conversed with each one of them. I cannot tell you, I've been surprised, by the sense that they are so grateful to be here, to have this opportunity.
Even though it's July,
even though it's July in one of the four ovens in China, and again and again they've said this has been a life-changing experience for me to be here.
I can only imagine. Yeah.
and interacting with ordinary, humble, you know, regular Chinese people in their daily lives, to see that up front and to interact with them. They have said it's just changed their way of thinking. And one of the requirements of this program is each of the teachers has to prepare a lesson plan and to incorporate their experiences into their curriculum. They all said, we can't wait for September. We are so ready to teach, bring something so fresh and so, you know, from right fresh out of our experience into the U.S. classroom back in San Francisco. So seeing that direct personal and professional impact through this program, I think just reinforces the value of the vision of C100's, you know, goal to for educational exchange, and also to encourage this people-to-people diplomacy.
So if people want to get involved somehow in supporting the Committee of 100 work, where do we go to do that?
Definitely contact us. We're now our headquarters here in New York, and we welcome suggestions and hosting some of our leaders, for example, or the teachers, individual teachers are recruited in the Bay Area, and we often look for ideas to include in a curriculum, in an itinerary that we can broaden their horizon. And so, for example, Kaiser, you would be a very good guest for some of our leaders to meet with.
Yeah, I would be delighted to meet with them, either in a personal faculty or wearing my Baidu hat.
Yes.
I'd be happy to do either one. We can talk about that later. Let's wrap up here and go to recommendations. I'm sure I'm really, really curious to see what you guys have to recommend. Angie, why don't we start with you?
Yes. So, I mean, much of what we talked about today was comparing the different differences in different surveys that ironically have come all together at the same time.
Which shows, you know, how important people
shows
think.
It is a very important relationship. But the underlying theme is that there is distrust. There are challenges with this bilateral relationship, but there's also agreement that this is the most important global relationship, not just within the two countries, and that there are much more important actionable steps, more important than what the numbers are telling us. Individual numbers might vary, so I would say that while numbers are static, we are now asking ourselves, well, so what?
Mm-hmm.
What do we do? We have these numbers. There are issues with this relationship. Then what? So the recommendations outline areas where we think could build up this mutual distrust that is quite prevalent in different research. Outside of the survey, there are other research papers that also have underscored the issue of distrust. And with the recommendations that we have outlined, we have already taken steps to look at areas to build a trust. For example, just 3 weeks ago, we were in Washington and we announced the release of a statement of principle,
mm-hmm.
Urging all the candidates running for offices not to use the China issues, not to use anti-China bashing in images that are derogatory to Chinese Americans, and to use a better platform to discuss China issues, rather than denigrating a group of Chinese Americans by using mockery accents and that really do not add to the discourse and could actually exacerbate
the distrust. Who is
that
Michigan?
There is Hostra.
And
then last
Pete
year also
Hextra,
with the midterms.
Yeah, that was his name, right? President Obama actually did a little bit of it himself just the other day, or invoking this. Right. I mean, there's a difference between China bashing and just invoking real trade issues,
which are
very real.
And secondly, we've also supported a binational commission that is a partnership between USC at the University of Southern California,
mm-hmm. the
School
US-China
of Annenberg,
the
School
Annenberg
of Annenberg School, which took over the China Institute.
Right.
And they have partnered with Beida here at Peking University School of International Studies. So the two deans, Dean Ernest Wilson and Dean Wang Qixi, Professor Wang Qixi, who is mm-hmm. a very respected figure in the U.S. on foreign policy, they co-chair this binational commission, the sole purpose of which is to study trust-building activities. They will seek to publish a white paper, and that would be in time for the presidential election to recommend these activities, and the Committee 100 is a proud sponsor of this commission. So these are some of the steps that we are taking as deliverables on our own recommendations.
So what about leadership development? I mean, when you talk about leadership development, I'm sure it includes some of the things you've already discussed, but what are some of
the... There were some of the... When we talked about the younger people that have that harbor a much better relationship but much more favorable impressions of each other, we want to take this opportunity to further advance this pipeline of future leaders, both here in China and in the United States. So in different regions where we have robust leadership, we have quarterly discussion roundtables that seek to engage these emerging leaders on an issue just such as U.S.-China relations. And here in China, we have a program called the Leadership Scholarship Program, where every year we choose from 14 top universities. Students that receive our scholarships get a chance to be mentored by Committee 100 members and have a chance to visit the United States and participate in our annual conferences.
Well, that's great. That's great. Well, let's wrap up this segment on this happy note and move on to the segment where we each make a recommendation about something that we've read or something that we've seen recently, an article, a blog post. A place, even. I think, Angie, you had a place that you wanted to recommend. Is that right?
I had a place that I was very impressed about, and it really touched something in my heart when I saw the philanthropy at its best, and when someone is teaching a village to be self-sufficient. One of our members, Cyrus Tong, no relation to me, has funded a foundation that that helps a village right outside of Xi'an. And I had a chance to visit that in May when I was taking a delegation of civic leaders. And all of the civic leaders were so impressed with the work of the foundation.
What's helping, the name of the village, do you remember?
It's Beishuangmiao Chun. It's a village that Mr. Tong has helped bring in architectural scholars that can help stifle diseases amongst the cows. So they develop a cooperative where the farmers can bring all of their livestock to be cared for by the co-op, and the profits are shared. And they yield a much, much more productive crop. And the farmers are also taught to grow cherries rather than wheat, that are much harder and have a much lower selling price. So as a result, the farmers are much more self-sufficient, and they have a much heightened quality of life. And you can just see that the beaming happiness, the pride that they have, the villagers, when they're able to elevate their standard of living.
It sounds like a good story for some of our reporters who may be listening.
Yes.
Do you know if it's been covered much in mainstream media?
I don't believe so. And I think that's such a beautiful story to see.
Very cool. Very cool. I'd like to check it out. What about you, Mercy? What do you have for us?
Well, you know, two themes that have come out of this conversation are youth, the importance of young people, and popular culture. And I am thinking about a Chinese-American young man. He's a jazz singer. His name's Christopher Jang. And what he has done is presented Chinese classical songs in the form of jazz.
Mm.
And he has his own little group, and I believe they cut their first CD already under Chris's name.
Based where?
In New York.
Okay, in New York.
He performed recently, and he's kind of like Michael Bublé or Harry Connick, Chinese-American version, just much younger, but I think he embodies the spirit of artistry and promise.
How do you spell his surname?
His surname, he actually spells it J-A-Y-N-G.
J-A-Y-N-G.
I think he was born in Taiwan.
Where Romanizations are completely random.
Right, completely.
No vowels.
Right, but anyway, he's got that voice there, and he's trying to.
Well, I'll check him out tonight.
Yeah, yeah.
That sounds really cool. Well, I mean, I don't know how you jazzify that incredibly dull pentatonic.
Right. But I give him credit for trying.
Right. You know, I've done the same with heavy metal. I've done the heavy metal version as well. Okay. So he's my more talented jazz counterpart. Awesome. I'm going to go from the very young to the very old, okay. To a nonagenarian that many of you are doubtless familiar with, Sidney Rittenberg, who, of course, came here to China in the 1940s and stayed after the revolution. And, you know, he spent two stretches in prison. There's a new documentary about him. And there's actually a review of the documentary titled The American Who Stood Alongside Mao Zedong by Jeffrey Wasserstrom at UC Irvine, who's been a guest on this show before. It's in The Atlantic this month. Definitely check it out. It's a very, very good review. I'm looking very much forward to seeing the documentary itself, because Sidney Rittenberg is a man who has, I think, not made any apologies for his past. I mean, he's faced it very, very squarely. I mean, he's not trying to excuse or justify some of the things that he's done in the past, but he's not run away from it. And at the same time, he has his eyes very much open about China today, and is one of the wiser observers of modern China, of contemporary China. Highly recommend reading this review by Jeff Wasserstrom, and of course checking out the documentary. Angie Tang, thank you so much for coming. And Mercy Guo, thank you so much.
It was very, very good having you both.
And folks, we'll look forward to seeing you again next week on the Seneca Podcast. Take care.